Hello and welcome to Savor, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we have an episode for you about blueberries.
Yes! I love blueberries!
Oh, I think this is the most excited I've heard you about an episode in a minute.
Oh, they're my top 10. I love blueberries. Yes. Yes.
Oh, yay.
It was one of the many nicknames I've picked up over the years was blueberry.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because of mainly late night excursions to IHOP, because you never go for breakfast. You go at night.
Yeah.
And I would order double blueberry pancakes and top them with blueberry syrup. And usually when I did this, I was wearing this huge hoodie. I know you've seen it, Lauren. It's this huge Georgia Tech hoodie that I have that's navy blue. It makes me look like the person from Willy Wonka.
Oh, Violet. Violet. You're turning Violet. Violet. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I always want to say Veruca Salt. I think it's because I know that's the only name I know, but I know it's not her.
Yeah.
Violet is an easy name to remember, so I don't know what my problem is. Yeah, and I love them so much. I had a friend, she would make this special blueberry pie just for me every year.
Aww.
But then she would have to take me for a walk like a child because I would get so hyper. And like it's, and this was in college. I would get so hyper. Yeah, and when I got back from China, when I first hung out with a group of friends, they text me and they're like, what are the things you've missed? You've been gone for like a year. Now that you're back in the U.S., what do you want? And I said, cheese and blueberries. It was great.
Oh, I believe you. I mean, blueberries go really well with cheese. I mean, cheese goes really well with pretty much everything, but
that's been my experience too, Lauren. And yeah, when I was growing up, we had these blueberry bushes all around our house, and we would go blueberry picking, and it was the best. They were so good. They were so, so sweet.
Oh, yeah.
I do feel like it is in a lot of summer desserts here in the United States. Also, blueberry muffins. Those are so good. I could go on and on and on. I have to stop. But
no, they're a great addition to baked goods. I don't think that there is anything on this planet that I enjoy more than picking a berry off of a bush and then eating it.
Yeah.
Immediately. Like it is just the absolute best thing on the planet. We have a very sad potted blueberry plant in this household. It does fruit, but I don't think that we're treating it well enough to get it to like fruit well.
Spite berries.
yeah, they're disappointed in us, to be honest.
You're making them feel blue.
Oh no. This is another character in our cartoon comic strip, etc.
I think it'll go. A lot of our characters are sad and or troubled. So I don't know what that says.
I don't know.
Blueberry will fit right in.
I don't care to investigate that venue of my inner psyche today. Thank you.
Yes.
Like, Lauren, why are you making all these food products depressed? I'm like, I'm sure it's fine.
Definitely fine. I feel like the Toastmaster is a cheerful character. Just toast it. I mean, I wouldn't say he's like the most stable of our food-based individuals. But
if y'all don't remember all of this, back when we did jelly donuts.
Yep.
I think that was the instigation of this. I think it's mostly Annie came up with this character of the dunker, who's this donut who's a cop who, you know,
has a bite taken out of her. She's seen some stuff.
And then all of these other characters kind of spawn. Anyway, blueberries. Yeah, I like them. I have family up in New Hampshire, and they grow, they have wild blueberries all around their area. And so I've gone picking with them, and sometimes they'll send me like a little jar of jam at Christmas, and it's the best jam. Oh,
yes.
I adore it. I adore it. Love a berry.
That sounds amazing. That sounds so good. Since 1974, July, which is the month we are in as we record this. So we've done it again, Lauren. has been designated as National Blueberry Month. So, timely.
Timely.
Yes. But I guess that brings us to our question. Blueberries. What are they?
Well, blueberries are, for once, pretty much what they say on the package. They are blue in color, and they are berries.
That's such a relief. I feel like all the time, the berry part is the part I would be like, it's not really a berry.
Yeah, the berries and the nuts. To be honest, I Googled this to make super extra double sure about 3 seconds ago.
We've been burned before.
Strawberries, bananas, yeah. What are you doing? You can see our episodes on those if you want to. Strawberries are not berries. Bananas are. It's a wacky world in botany. At any rate, blueberries. There's just a whole bunch of species and varieties of blueberries, all in the genus Vaccinium. Yeah, we'll go with that. It's a broad genus that also includes stuff like cranberries, lingonberries, some types of huckleberries. The blueberry plant is a deciduous shrub that can grow up to a couple of feet, usually like less than a meter tall, and will grow these pretty little sprays of frilly, bell-shaped flowers that, when pollinated, will each develop into a globe or sort of squished globe-shaped fruit with a little star-shaped crown where the fruit connects to the stem. They were apparently previously called starberries way back in the day.
Oh, that's so pretty.
Yeah.
That sounds like I'm playing a Final Fantasy VII game or something.
Oh, right? Yeah, that sounds like a food item that's going to give you the good bonus, right?
Oh, yeah.
The fruit will develop from green to pink to red to blue-violet as they ripen and will reach anywhere from like a quarter inch to about an inch in diameter. That's like half a centimeter to about 2 centimeters, with a really thin edible skin surrounding a kind of mealy to juicy flesh that contains several tiny seeds called nutlets. They register as like a fine grit. You don't really notice them. And the fruit ranges from sweet to sweet tart to like pretty tart. It's a kind of intense but pleasant flavor burst in your mouth when you bite through the skin. They typically flower by mid to late spring. The fruit will be ripe by mid to late summer. Like I said, they do need to be pollinated in order to develop fruit and seeds. And they are best pollinated by wild bees rather than honeybees or other pollinators. And so there's been a lot of research recently into how the general use of insecticides has affected certain species of blueberries. There's even a couple species of wild bees that are specifically referred to as blueberry bees.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And there's even this special move that bumblebees and blueberry bees will do called buzz pollination, which, bee aside, so these two types of bees, and they haven't really witnessed this in other types of bees, will kind of go up to this bell-shaped blueberry flower that, you know, has like a relatively narrow opening, and they'll kind of grab on to the pollen-bearing bits of the flower inside of the petals, and then just vibrate their little bodies like real hard, just poofing this cloud of pollen out of the flowers and onto themselves.
Oh,
I know.
That sounds so cute.
I know. I love it. Yeah. And so apparently it's just real effective at producing pollination. And I, bee aside, yeah, always excited about it.
Yes. Bees are so cool.
Oh, so, see our honey episode for more on that. and you can grow new blueberry plants either by seed or by cuttings. Different varieties go to different uses. Wild types are often a little smaller and tartar, and so they'll go to processing to be frozen or canned or dried. That may or may not be what winds up in a lot of your processed baked goods. Some cultivars are even used ornamentally, and I've read are really good for like bonsai type applications. So,
ooh.
Yeah, I don't know. But yes, the resulting fruit can, it's small enough to be like a handheld snack, so they're often eaten out of hand, but can also be processed into jams or jellies or baked goods. You can make wine and other alcohols from them. You can add them to smoothies or whatever you want. I think that there's generally fewer savory applications for blueberries than sweet applications. But yeah, I mean, they would go great in a salad, something like that.
Yeah. They have a lot of flavor for like a really small berry.
Yeah.
And I probably went 7 to 10 years where every day for breakfast, I ate yogurt, blueberries, and honey.
So yeah. Good. Oh, yeah. Oh, I love a fresh blueberry and some yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
Just this little snap and pop and oof. Ugh.
Yes.
I'm like, oh, no, I need to go buy some blueberries. Okay. Anyway.
I know. what about the nutrition?
Blueberries are pretty good for you. They contain very little fat, a bunch of sugar and fiber, good pops of vitamins and minerals. They will help fill you up, but to keep you going, I would say to add some protein and a fat to the mix in there. And okay, so we'll get into why this happened during our history outline, but suffice it to say for right now that you have probably heard that blueberries are a super fruit.
Sounds kind of menacing when you say it like that.
should have been more that blueberries are a super fruit.
Yeah.
Is that more like
know.
It?
I'm not telling you how to interpret
somewhere
things.
In between. I feel somewhere in between about it. Okay, so in the 1990s and early 2000s, a lot was made of blueberries in the media because of this research into the amount of anthocyanins that they contain. And anthocyanins are these compounds that are responsible for the deep red to purple pigmentation of blueberries, cranberries, blackberries, stuff like that. And anthocyanins also happen to have a really high capacity as antioxidants, which means that that they are a type of molecule that can help prevent certain types of damage to cells, to like bodily cells, and therefore can sometimes help prevent diseases and conditions that could result from damage to your cells. Yeah. And blueberries do contain a lot, like over 2 to 3 times more than other common fruits like plums or grapes or raspberries. The thing is that the initial research that this was based on was just on the composition of blueberries, not on how much of what's in them actually gets used by your body when you eat them. So they're not like, they're really not like, oh, it's such a super food. Holy heck. But they're still good for you. research is ongoing. What it looks like as of 2019, according to the best medical research reviews that I could find, is that like there is good evidence that incorporating blueberries into your diet can help prevent stuff like cardiovascular disease, can help improve like glucose and insulin related functions, or at least help make it not get worse. That blueberries do have some anti-inflammatory and pro-immune system effects when you eat them, possibly because of like gut microflora and stuff like that. Really fun. Kind of too deep for right now. But yeah, as of right now, moderate intake is thought to be not a bad idea. If you had like maybe like a third of a cup of blueberries a day, if you enjoy doing that, and you know, it might help you mitigate the risk of some conditions related to the above. So,
oh, there you go.
There you go. Clear as a blueberry. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always a saver motto. You know, like I human bodies are complicated. More research is necessary before ingesting a medicinal amount of anything. Consult a doctor. But yeah, like a third a cup a day of blueberries, probably good for you. Certainly not going to hurt you. Check with your doctor.
That feels like a challenge. Now I'm thinking of all the ways blueberries could hurt you.
Well, oh gosh, is it? This isn't like, Annie, you would make such a good genie.
I would.
You're like, well, what about the choking hazard? Didn't think of that, did you?
You didn't think this one through, or this very obscure fact?
Oh,
that's
heck.
Why I'm a dungeon master. We do have some numbers for you.
We do.
So, largely in part to what Lauren was just talking about this, like, superfood belief, blueberry popularity is on the rise. The blueberry industry is estimated to be worth about $250 million. From 2005 to 2015, global blueberry production tripled, which I find really interesting because this takes place in, like, North America mostly.
But, yeah.
Since 2008, consumption of blueberries has doubled in the U.S., and U.S. per capita consumption is about 3 pounds. I think the comparison, though, is strawberries is 7 to 9.
Okay.
Yeah. The U.S. and Canada combined eat about 76% of global blueberry exports, and the U.S. is the largest global producer with 690 million pounds as of 2016. It is also the largest importer. About 27 countries cultivate blueberries commercially. So, yeah, a lot of blueberries getting eaten in Canada and the U.S.
Yep, we like them. I did not realize exactly how regional. This is one of the first ones that I think I was surprised by, that I just didn't know that it wasn't, that blueberries weren't such a thing.
Right. Me too.
More widespreadly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. About 58% of the blueberry crop in North America is frozen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so a lot of states, I'm putting a disclaimer here because I know there are other states I could have mentioned.
Oh, yes.
I know this.
Minnesota is already mad at you. Minnesota is already
mad at
you. Oh,
sorry, Minnesota. I didn't mention Georgia or South Carolina. Anyway, I'm talking about states that are very excited about blueberries. So one of them is North Carolina, big blueberry state. It's their highest ranked fruit crop, worth about $50 to $70 million. There's a North Carolina Blueberry Council Incorporated that many of the growers belong to. There's a North Carolina Blueberry Festival.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
New Jersey, also a big blueberry state. Hammonton, New Jersey, home of the Atlantic Blueberry Company, calls itself the blueberry capital of the world.
Mm.
The business has 1,000 acres of blueberries. And the blueberries, New Jersey's state fruit. But don't forget Maine! They're actually the world's largest producer of low brush or wild blueberries, churning out 90 million pounds of blueberries a year. Their official state berry is the wild blueberry.
Yeah, blueberry pie is their official state dessert. And however, climate change and the aforementioned pollination issues are really affecting crop yields there. As of 2020, Maine's wild blueberry crop was just 47.4 million pounds, which is the lowest in 16 years. It's like half of what it used to be.
Mm-hmm. A portion of the wild blueberries harvested in Maine are grown by Native American tribes. Some have recently sounded the alarm about the increased demand, especially in terms of expecting more blueberries out of less land. There are also issues of pricing and contracts with outside companies. So something else to keep in mind.
Yeah. But yeah, there are just so many blueberry festivals around the eastern U.S. over through the Great Lakes during the summer when the crops are coming in. There's a lot of like you-pick kind of situations, a lot of pancake breakfasts, a lot of pie eating contests.
Whew.
Annie's thinking about like the walk that she had to take after over sugaring on like a slice, I'm assuming.
Yes, that might kill me. Do not let me enter a blueberry pie eating contest, Lauren.
No matter
what I say.
Okay. All right. That's the line. I see you and I'm here to support your decisions.
Thank you. Oh, we do have a lot of history for you.
We do, but first we've got a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So, blueberries originated in North America, possibly after the last ice age. And actually, there's a really interesting scientific paper about this. And I tried to summarize it to put in here, but it was too confusing to summarize. It made sense. But basically, there's some really cool stuff happening with, like, fungi that is why blueberries, it helped blueberries survive.
Cool, yeah.
Like a symbiotic relationship. Native Americans ate wild blueberries fresh or dried and used them when making pemmican, which is sort of an early energy bar composed of fat, shredded jerky, fruits, and sometimes seeds or other nuts. I know we've talked about that in past episodes, probably cranberries. The berries were also used medicinally, and the roots of the blueberry bush were made into tea. Dried blueberries were prepared with dried cracked corn and water to make a sort of pudding. When colonists arrived, they added in butter, milk, and sugar to this pudding, if they could get sugar. These early berries were wild. No one was really looking to domesticate them, though indigenous peoples might have used controlled burns to promote the growth of blueberry bushes. In 1615, Samuel de Champlain described witnessing Native Americans harvesting blueberries near Lake Huron. He wrote of seeing women use, quote, blues in their cornmeal bread, going on to call the berries the, quote, manna of winter.
Oh.
Yeah. Around the same time, John Josselyn wrote of the medicinal uses of blueberries growing in northern New England, quote, to cool the heat of fevers and quench thirst. They are very good to allay the burning heat of fevers and hot agues, a fever that shakes the body, either in syrup or conserve. He wrote about folks eating the blueberries, too, particularly in sweeter dishes. There were a handful of descriptions around this time from European colonists and colonizers about blueberries. Jesuit missionary Paul Lejeune wrote in his book that, quote, some Native Americans imagine a paradise abounding in blueberries. Ooh. A bit later, Samuel Hearn wrote that blueberries were, quote, seldom ripe till September, at which time the leaves turn to a beautiful red and the fruit, though small, have as fine a bloom as any plum and are much esteemed for the pleasantness of their flavor. Ooh, much esteemed.
Yeah, it's accurate. Totally
it
true.
It is. Despite the fact that the U.S. had plenty of berries, they didn't seem to really take off in the country until later, which is the source of several articles digging into why that is, something I also found interesting, perhaps a future episode. The believed first known written use of blueberry pie appeared in 1829 in the New England Farmer, while the first known written recipe might have appeared in 1850. Commercial harvest of blueberries in North America didn't really get going until about the 1840s and during the Civil War, after sardine canneries who had lost their market in the South started canning blueberries instead to sell to Union soldiers. And this helped develop a taste for sweet berries. Okay. And I love this. This was a surprise. I'd never heard about any of this. While the specific history of who and how and when a food is domesticated from its wild form is often lost to time, all those facts are often lost to time, we do know what happened in the case of the blueberry.
Yes.
Yes. Their domestication took place in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. During the late 1800s and early 1900s, the White family, a family of Quakers, owned a lot of land in the Pine Barrens. I read somewhere it was 1 million acres.
Oh, okay.
That's a lot of land. They called this land and the buildings on it White's Bog, and they grew cranberries. Joseph White and his oldest daughter, Elizabeth, took care of most of the farm work. From a young age, Elizabeth took an interest in farming and kept her ears open for any farming opportunities. When she was 39 in 1910 or 1911, she discovered a book on blueberries compiled by botanist Frederick Covell for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And this book, or report, because I found the report. I didn't find the book. But anyway, whatever it was, it really caught her interest, especially Covell's theory that blueberries, unlike most plants, needed acidic soil to grow and that they benefit from fungi penetrating their roots, like I said.
Yeah.
Elizabeth wrote a letter to Covell's boss proposing that she and her family could conduct experiments on growing blueberries on their farm, pointing out that blueberries already grew well on the land and that they'd pay the USDA to do it, too.
Hmm.
She made sure to make a carbon copy of the letter and kept it in a safe for many years, which I love. So this letter will never be lost to time. It was like a fireproof safe.
So good.
Well, she was right to protect it, I guess, because the letter worked. Months later, Coville himself showed up at Whitesbog. Elizabeth sent out notices offering money to any locals who could provide bushes with large blueberries. Over 100 folks answered the call, and Elizabeth named each bush after the person who brought it.
Huh.
From these bushes, Coville figured out how to essentially clone the bushes from cuttings. Some were better producers than others. Some did so well that they're still growing to this day. Coville cross-pollinated bushes as well, selectively breeding for bushes that produced bigger, tastier berries. Of the 120 samples they received, 118 got tossed. And from the two remaining, they took 35,000 cuttings.
Whoa.
And from all of that, they kept only four. By 1916, they'd arrived at a blueberry crop that consistently yielded a berry that looked and tasted the same. A new commercial blueberry industry was born. I know, I love this. One of the successful bushes came from a man named Rube Leek. Coville and White decided Rube wasn't a nice enough name and that they couldn't use Leek because of the plant by the same name. So Coville got the idea to add an L to the end of Rube, either in honor of the man's last name and or because it sounded like something that makes money, to arrive at the name Rubel, or Ruble, which is still used today. It's one of the blueberry crops still around today.
Huh.
Which is great. Elizabeth would later write that this whole experience was a, quote, joyous memory for her, and that, quote, encouraging developments came thick and fast. Dr. Coville and I gloated over them together, the enthusiasm of each fanning to brighter flame that of the other. The pair worked together for over 20 years. She was instrumental in creating the blueberry market and helped form the first blueberry farmers co-op. She apparently contacted suppliers and suggested they sell blueberries packaged in cellophane so people could see the berries, which is still around today, too.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. She co-authored papers about blueberries. She was called the Blueberry Queen. So fun. Such a fan. Fun story.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Heck yeah, Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was so much research into blueberry hybrids going on in the 1920s. There were a lot of papers being published about it.
Yes. I guess a hard pivot. Before his execution in 1927, Niccolò Sacco asked that blueberry pie be his last meal, and that was a rabbit hole because I didn't know who that was or anything about that whole situation. Different podcast, but whoa.
Yeah. We are not true crime. But very rarely, anyway.
Very rarely. Very rarely.
Food sometimes. Crime. True food crime.
Capone shows up. I don't know. The Atlantic Blueberry Company was founded in 1936 by the Galletta family. Blueberries were first planted in North Carolina, also in 1936. Apparently, an entrepreneur who grew blueberries up in New Jersey was looking to extend the crop's growing season. So he went looking around for other places to plant them, settling on North Carolina.
The book Blueberries for Sale was published by Robert McCloskey in 1948. It won the Caldecott Award in 1949. If you guys did not grow up with this book, it is a charming picture book about picking blueberries.
Oh, I did not grow up with this book.
Oh, Blueberries for Sale. Yeah. There's a bear cub involved too, and it's there's a whole parallel between the bear cub and its mom and the little girl and her mom.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Of course, my mind immediately goes to a dark place. Oh.
No, it's a children's picture book, Annie. Children's picture book.
Got it. With the commercial availability of blueberries, improved innovations around freezing and refrigeration, introduction of new varieties of bushes that can grow in high temperature environments, including here in Georgia, which is one of the biggest blueberry producing states. See, I didn't mention us at the top. Blueberry production and demand has continued to increase.
As you said earlier, over half of our blueberry crop here in the States winds up being frozen. And so all of this production really kicked off in the 1940s with the development of frozen food technology. And you can see we have a early episode on that one. Mm-hmm. In the early 1980s, blueberry picking was promoted as this big like recreational and or tourist activity. And apparently some 20% of summer tourists to the Great Lakes region picked blueberries while they were there.
Wow. The blueberry got another boost in the 1990s and 2000s, like you mentioned, Lauren, when a lot of articles and research came out suggesting the health benefits of blueberries, some labeling it as a superfood.
And, okay, so apparently, I read an article from The Atlantic about this. There was this one marketing guy by the name of John Sauve, who just really got the blueberry rolling circa 1997. He was working at the time as the executive director of the Wild Blueberry Association of North America. He was there 93 to 2004. And yeah, he was the guy who looked at these studies coming out starting in 1996 about antioxidants in blueberries. And he was like, oh, we can turn this into profits. So he and other folks in the blueberry industry started funding more research. By 1999, there was global media coverage about blueberries and antioxidants. For example, sales of wild blueberries in Japan went from about 2 million pounds a year in 1996 to 30 million by 99.
Wow. I did see that Japan was like one of the the U.S. and Canada largest consumers. And I was kind of like, how did that happen? There you go.
Health marketing. Yeah. to end on a down note, just this year, there's research out about, how climate change in the Northeast is really negatively impacting blueberries. It's been warmer. There's been less rainfall. They're, not like the thirstiest crop, but they do need water. And so it's... just adding challenges.
Adding challenges. Mm-hmm. My poor blueberry. My poor sweet blueberry.
Do what you can to combat climate change. Call your senators.
For the blueberry. Think of the blueberry.
Exactly.
Well, that's about what we have to say on the blueberry for now.
It is. We do have some listener mail for you, but first we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with listener mail.
Was that Violet being rolled away by the Oompa Loompas?
It was. And it was also an ode to one of my favorite weird rides, E.T. The Adventure.
Oh.
There's a creature in there that talks like that. And he says, "Welcome home, you've arrived." And it makes me laugh and laugh and laugh. That ride is strange.
That ride is very, very odd. If y'all have never witnessed it, whenever you feel safe getting back out to a theme park, I recommend going to Universal Studios in Orlando and beelining straight to the E.T. ride.
Oh, yeah. It's the best, too. Well, we're going to ruin it, Lauren. But as of now, it's usually nobody's riding it. So there's no wait.
Yeah. If you get there and there's a wait, it's our fault. And you can you can write us angry letters.
send a note our way. Yeah. Although I'll be pretty happy. I'm afraid they're going to tear it down. And it is quite the sight to behold. You can find it online on YouTube because, of course, I've looked it up. I very much enjoy that ride. Even though it's so weird. Casey wrote, "I am a longtime listener, yet this is my first time writing in. Oh, hello. While listening to your latest podcast on cilantro, I just had to share with you all my experiences with cilantro as a super taster."
Ah.
Yeah. "Growing up, I was always a picky eater, like so many children. Fast forward to studying anthropology in college, I participated in many PTC tests where I discovered that I am a super taster and not just picky. After participating in this test in so many classes, I found myself very jealous of my classmates who only tasted paper versus a bitter, soapy taste plus paper. Now aware of my super tasting powers, my mother uses me in her herb garden whenever she can't tell the difference between her parsley, cilantro, and catnip, which all grew pretty wild next to each other. This always brings such horror to her cat's face as it taste tests the leaves of what the cat assumes is precious catnip. I am sure you all are wondering my thoughts on cilantro at this point. I am in the camp against cilantro and parsley, but in favor of coriander. Huh. However, I discovered coulantro, C-U-L-A-N-T-R-O, when I started growing my own herbs. This plant is, from my understanding, the American cousin of cilantro. It doesn't taste like soap to me and thrives in my warm, sunny Florida yard. I never have to replant it. It is a perennial and often pops up everywhere. So many asked me about my odd-looking plant, and of course I offer leaves to try. The shock on their faces when they taste the plant and discover it does indeed taste like cilantro, but different, always brings me such joy. I am attaching a photo of my little coulantro plant all in bloom. I hope this plant brings hope to all those who also dislike the taste of cilantro, but love foods that feature the herb.
Oh.
I've never heard of coulantro. I can't believe I didn't come across that in the research.
I came across it as like a parallel or varietal, or I wasn't sure if there was a difference or not. So I am very intrigued to hear that there is a flavor difference between that and regular cilantro. That's great.
Yeah. And the picture looks amazing. As someone who struggled to grow plants before, I'm always so happy when I see one. It looks healthy and
that's
happy.
Really thriving. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Hannah wrote, a little while ago, one of Atlas Obscura's emails included a link to an article about pastilla, a sort of apple meringue cookie from Russia. The recipe included directions for cooking the apples down, but since I had just made applesauce a few days before, I figured I could just use that. Also, as a vegan and lover of chickpeas, I had a lot of aquafaba in my freezer. Aquafaba is the liquid left over from cooking chickpeas and can be used as a substitute for egg whites in vegan dishes. Maybe a new episode idea? So my first trial involved trying to whip up the aquafaba and applesauce together in a food processor, since I don't have a stand mixer. Mistake number one. I thought it was a smart idea, but apparently you really do need a mixer to get the right volume. So I decided to do some more research before my next trial. In my research, I found out that you can reduce aquafaba on the stove to get the consistency of what comes out of a can of chickpeas. Mine was pretty watery, so I decided to give that a try. Unfortunately, I had a friend over who distracted me by wanting to watch The Good Place, so I forgot about the pot of aquafaba on the stove and ended up with a bunch of burnt sludge. Mistake number two. Maybe I should have taken this as an omen, but alas, having ruined my entire stock of aquafaba, I bought a can of chickpeas from the store. Of course, the pull tab broke off as I tried to open the can, but I persevered with the aid of a can opener. Thus began trial number three. I used my hand mixer to whip up the aquafaba and was actually getting a lot of air into it. Adding cream of tartar really helps with keeping the structure once it's been whipped. My aquafaba was getting light and fluffy, so I slowly added in my previously flat applesauce and aquafaba mixture and had to separate the mixture into multiple bowls to avoid spraying sticky apple droplets everywhere as it expanded. So now I had the right texture. I followed the directions of setting my oven to the lowest setting, lining a cookie sheet with parchment paper, and reserving a cup and a half of apple mixture to glue the pieces together once I had my cooked meringue sheet. I put my cookie sheet in the oven and patiently waited the 4 to 6 hours the recipe said to dry out / lightly cook the meringue. When I checked at 4 hours, it was still very wet, so I decided to wait another half hour. But when I checked at hour 4.5, I no longer had beautiful apple fluff. My concoction had fallen, and now I had something akin to crunchy fruit leather. I pulled it out of the oven and let it cool before putting the whole thing in the fridge to attempt to peel the paper off another day. But I still wasn't done. I was determined to make this work. So I took the cup and a half of apple whip I had put in the fridge and put it in a smaller dish and stuck it in the toaster oven on keep warm, hoping that that wouldn't be too hot. I was much more diligent about checking my mixture this time, and the second it started to fall, I pulled it out of the toaster oven, let it cool, and decided it could go in the freezer to be eaten as an apple whipped cream sort of thing, which was delicious. So, neither of the desserts I ended up with were what I wanted, but maybe I discovered something new? I'm too busy trying to pull parchment paper off crunchy fruit leather to really figure that one out right now.
I love it. Such determination.
Oh, goodness. Just, yeah.
I usually give up at my first food omen. I'm like, no.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's the thing. Like, I feel like if you make it past the first one, you're just in it. You're just in it and you're there. And that's it. That's absolutely it.
That's wise.
Yeah. I didn't look up the pronunciation for either the apple meringue pastilla. I just pronounced it pastilla, or for aquafaba. But I assume that that's what that is.
That's how I've always said aquafaba. And this was a request to do an episode on that. And a lot of people have requested aquafaba, which, yes, I'm hoping we're pronouncing it correctly. We'll find out.
Yeah. I've been looking at it on our idea list and going like, oh, maybe not today.
I feel like almost all of our ideas on there have reached that point. We've gone through most of the like lighter lifts and heavy quotes because there's never a lighter lift.
Oh yeah. No, this one I was like, it's blueberries are a relatively new world thing. It'll be short. It'll be easy.
And I was like, maybe.
You were right, Annie. You were much righter than I was, at any rate.
In this one instance. Yeah.
No. That's not how I. Oh goodness.
Terrible. Just terrible, Lauren. You owe me a packet of blueberries.
Okay.
And I will stand for nothing less.
Got you. No problem.
Awesome. Well, thanks to both of those listeners for writing in. If you would like to write to us, you can or email us hello@savorpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Yes, that's the third one. All three places, we are at SavorPod, and we do hope to hear from you. Savor is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.